welcome along to The Pastor's Heart. It's great that you could join us. Dominic Steele is my name. Each week in this program, we try to serve pastors, Christian leaders, in our collective task of bringing glory to our Lord Jesus Christ. And today, we're thinking about how the culture has changed, and given those changes, how our task as Christian leaders has changed. There was a gathering of Australian Christian leaders a week ago, and it was called the Australian Community and Church Summit, and Mark McCrindle was the lead presenter. He's our guest this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Mark, of course, is from McCrindle Research, and Mark, in our journey on the Pastor's Heart, we've mostly had people directly engaged in Coalface Ministry, but you run your own business researching the way the Australian community thinks. But can I just start with your heart? And as you look at people, and I'm just thinking of the Lord Jesus looking out at people and seeing them lost and sheep without a shepherd, and you don't just see them as sheep, you see them as sheep with an iPhone. What does it do to your heart?
Well, you know, I think there are amazing opportunities here in Australia. I think we are very blessed to have these times and the freedoms and the access to the information, the technology that we have. And even though, you know, some of the trend lines might be headed in this direction, Jesus said, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So regardless of any particular statistics, you know, I think that Christ is on the throne and we have great opportunities, great warmth within which we operate here in Australia.
Mm. What was your journey to getting into social research?
I started in psychology, and so I did the psychology course at university, and then rather than head into clinical psych, which was the pathway, I just ended up changing direction.
You kind of worked out in prac sessions when you were doing prac at uni or something, that wasn't you? Or
wasn't quite my thing, and yet I loved social psychology. I loved how societies, groups, and communities work together, and what makes them function. So, you know, made that my work in terms of social research.
And you're a Christian all the way along?
Yes, yeah. Grew up in a Christian household, made my decision as a youngster, and have, you know, continued that path. And, you know, really as a guy in business and looking at numbers, it's like, I guess, all of us, we see how key Christian faith is to our work and to our output.
Mm. And then as you do the social analysis, I mean, you're doing it mostly for secular clients, but you've, I guess, as a Christian person, you've always got your eye on what's going on spiritually in the community. Yeah. What are some of the changes that are coming up for us?
Well, the census data, which, you know, tracks this nation every 5 years, is fascinating. And probably one of the standout facts was this decline in the total proportion of people identifying with Christianity in the most recent data. And it went in 5 years from 61% of Australians in a voluntary question, what is your religion, saying Christianity, down to 52%. Mm-hmm. No other area in the census dropped as dramatically as that. Mm-hmm. So that was quite significant. And then we've done our own surveying work on this and found that if you take it further and say, okay, that's your religion, but would you call yourself a Christian? We're down to about 38% of Australians, which is quite interesting, that drop-off. You know, religion number two in Australia, Islam, is at 2.6%. And it's different nomenclature there. So if someone says, my religion is Islam, they'll also say I'm a Muslim, and they'll also most likely practice in some active way. With Christianity, it's different. So more than half the population says Christianity. Only about one in three say, and I'll call myself a Christian. And less than half of those will actually attend church. So there's a lot of drop-off.
And perhaps, would you say, an even smaller percent really are spiritually born again?
Exactly. And so if we wanted to give some numbers to it, 52% say Christianity is their religion, 38% say, I call myself a Christian. About half that number, and it's actually 16% is the latest, will attend church once a month or more. When we've asked this question to a representative sample, are you active in the practice of your faith? Is it daily? And is God number one in your life?
Yeah.
You get down about half of that, about 7% of the population.
Really? It's higher than 7%, yeah. I mean, where I am, in the inner city of Sydney, 7% would be revival.
Sure. So, you know, half of those regular churchgoers say, you know, I'm there all the time, you know, Christianity is my thing. And now, again, you know, what that means to those individuals is probably variable. But the point is, across a few questions, you go from 52% saying Christianity to 7% that we might say are full-on or active in their faith.
Now, what difference has immigration made? We've got a question on that from Alexander Pernamo, and he'd like to know how many and what percentage immigrants there are who are professing as Christian, what kind of churches they're attending, ethnic specific, or English speaking.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, some people.
But big picture first, what difference does the immigration made over the last two decades to?
It's made a big difference to our cultural diversity.
Yeah.
More than one in four of us in Australia born overseas. And it's made a big difference to our religious diversity as well. And mm-hmm. so it's not a Christianity-only dominance anymore. In fact, if you compare the answer to that question on religion with people's backgrounds, something interesting comes up, and that is that the people that are coming to Australia, our current migration moves, are more likely to not say Christianity than Christianity. So the nations... So country of birth of Australians that are most likely, more than average, to say Christianity, people coming from the Oceania region, mm-hmm. Fiji and the islands, people coming from Western Europe, particularly Southern Europe mm-hmm. As well, Italy, Greece, America, more likely than average to say Christianity. But that's not our migration pattern. It's actually Middle East, it's Africa, and particularly Southeast Asia, where they're less likely than the average resident to say Christianity. So we're actually... bringing to Australia a mission field, you know, people right. less likely yeah, to, yeah. to identify with Christian things.
So, broadly speaking, the migration has contributed, at least partially, to that drop in Christian identification in Australia.
Exactly. And the rise in the non-Christian religions, which are now in total 9%.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a big difference between Christianity at 52% and all other religions combined at 9%, but nonetheless, they have been growing from a low base, and it's just reflective of our diverse society.
Well, it has anecdotally felt like the new migrant has been more open to the gospel than the Anglo. Is that right?
Yes, and it's certainly right to say that the people coming to Australia are more religious than the average Australian. Now, not more Christian, but certainly more open to religious things mm-hmm. and more likely to have a religion of their own. If we look at the rise in no religion, which mm-hmm. has been a big rise in the census, it's gone from a little over 1 in 5 to getting close to 1 in 3 now. It's mm-hmm. more than 30%. And that is more likely long-term local residents. Mm-hmm. Those coming from other parts have other religions, and so just explore faith and religion as part of their worldview.
Yeah. Now, talk to us about millennials. Crystal ball for me. Well, first of all, introduce me to them.
Well, they're sometimes called Generation Y,
yeah.
those born from 1980, we say through to 1994. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what's often thrown into the Generation Y millennial phrase is Generation Z. So that's the
yeah.
next 15 years from 1995
yeah.
to 2009. So we're talking about young adults, young parents indeed, moving in the older edge there, down to the teenagers and children. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this 21st century generation of young people. And they have been shaped in this digital economy with the devices in a global world of connectivity where the visual means of communication is more than just the written forms, where the social influence, not just the experts, define
yep.
them, where they're global in that outlook and where they'll work and study, you know, not just the local but the global. So that certainly changes worldview and perception. When we break down the census data by age group, they're more likely to say no religion, less likely to say Christianity. So any sense of cultural Christianity in Australia is evaporating. And those who say Christianity, particularly in the younger generation, are more likely to mean it.
Now, you had a quote, "It's not that we don't care on purpose, it's just that we don't care." Generation Z don't care about anything?
Well,
don't care about the gospel?
That quote came through in a focus group for a young person. We were actually talking about financial products and their superannuation
yeah.
future. But it highlights the fact that unless we can communicate to their area of interest, they're not trying to be a difficult audience or market. They just, you know, don't tune in the traditional ways. And I think it's particularly true with Christian things. If we're not understanding their context and their perspective, then chances are they're not just going to tune in, because, as I said, the idea that Christianity is just part of the upbringing and world view of modern Australians is no longer the case.
Mm, okay. So in a moment we'll talk about the way different people think, and I want to just do a little exploration of modernity, post-modernity, post-post-modernity.
Mm.
But before we get to that, more on how how they are, what they're like? Do you know, what does turn them on? Yeah.
Well, let's look at some of the data we know about them. They're staying in education longer. So, in fact, for Generation Y, for us Gen Xers, less than one in four has a uni degree. Yep. For this next generation down, it's more than one in three. It'll probably, with the school students of today, edge closer and closer to almost half of them with a university qualification.
And I was talking to somebody the other day, young man, and talking about gap year, and it's almost normal to take a break, to relax, not to be in a hurry to get going here. Whereas another friend of mine from Portugal, where their economy is not doing anywhere near as well, is saying, in Portugal, no one takes a gap year. Mm. We've got to get to work.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And I just thought, there's something very different about the 17-year-old in Australia to the 17-year-old growing up in Portugal. Do you want to just expand on that?
Yes, well, we are this...
From our money.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a generation that are well-supported. We're called the lucky country in so many ways. You know, we have been blessed, and this was a nation that didn't have any recession after the GFC, unlike most of the rest of the developed world. So, you know, it's a generation that hasn't had tough times. There is government funding available for further study. They're not in survival mode financially. Parents are able to help out sometimes, even as they come to get a deposit together for a home.
Yeah.
And so they have these multiple layers of safety nets, which, you know, can gives great opportunity, but can provide a sense of almost malaise and not.
Have you noticed that malaise? Yeah,
a little bit. Yeah, you know, where they their expectations are high. We talk about the confidence competence gap. You know, confidence is here. I'm going to do this and achieve this and be the boss tomorrow. Competence is lower because they're just starting out in life.
Can't actually turn up on time.
Well, yeah, and there can be a reality gap there, you know. Yeah. But they bring excellent skills, you know, digitally. They're the most formally educated generation ever, globally connected, as I said. So they've got a lot of strengths. But it is harder to get that commitment from them. They move, as I said, not just across more study, but more jobs, more roles, moving into you know, jobs that don't even exist. This is the world of change that has been the norm for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a question from James Smith. He says, and this is on Facebook, he says, in his book, The ABC of the XYZ, McCrindle, has a great table that compares the generations, including their communication preferences. It's clear that the typical church service is stuck in a culturally outdated mode of communication. Any suggestions on how we can change and examples of churches that have done that? Well, let's break that question down, because there's several aspects to that. The generations and their communication preferences. Mm. What do you mean by that?
Well, if we look at how learning takes place and how people consume content, it's definitely changed across the generations. There's an American researcher, Eric Sigmund, who looks at time use and how we spend it. Mm. And this generation have only ever known a world where they spend longer on screens per day in hours than they do in face-to-face interaction.
Yep.
And that changes your primary learning channel. They're more visual. They're more kinesthetic. They're activists. They're a few clicks away from
information. And so many of them operating two screens at once.
Well, that's right. Exactly. Which makes it
hard. Because one's not enough.
Yeah, that's right. All highly stimulated.
Yeah.
And so we've got to... Then how do we get cut through into that environment? They're not going to sit there and just listen in that traditional sense. But narrative works for them. Story and experience works for them. Testimony is very powerful for them. You know, we think our testimony's been there, done that, but not for this generation. They love the personal story. And even though I said they're more formally educated, not in an academic sense in terms of logic and reason, a lot more of their learning is a bit more experiential and a bit more subjective. And so sometimes those stories and our own example can work better than purely an apologetic. That's a really, you know, it's a truth analysis. May not engage as well in that sense.
Okay, well let's go to truth then, and I'm going to still dig around on this question. If we think of the modernist and truth is all, and the postmodernist rejecting the idea of truth, can you just give me your thing of what's after postmodernity?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly gets blurry after that because I think you get far more fragmentation. So, you know, what we have in Australia is both that modernity where there's this return to science and, you know, I believe the science and I want the
scientific research says.
Exactly. Yeah. And we found when we ran our study why this big rise in no religion, 30% now saying no religion, science was the main reason. I want evidence, I want reason, I want fact. So we've got a little bit of...
The people who were rejecting Christianity were rejecting Christianity because of the empirical evidence gap?
Exactly. That was the number one, the top three phrases. I prefer science and an evidence-based approach. Religion is a crutch for the weak. Religion is outdated and traditional. It was this scientism.
So you think that's the modernist speaking, the modernist in me speaking?
Yeah, the resurgence of that science dominance.
Because, well, I'm now confused. Because a uni girl said to me, and I found it such like that little quote you had a moment ago, it's not just that we don't care on purpose, it's just we don't care. She said to me, Dominic, my friends don't care if it's true or not. They want to know what difference it'll make to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, right. I mean, that's the kind of quote that you notice in a focus group, do you know?
Exactly.
And I noticed that, do you know? And so I've been trying to show people the difference it makes in their life, more than emphasising the truth claims. Now, do you want to agree with me, disagree with me there?
Well, I think that's part of this post-modernity,
yeah.
You know, is the fragmentation, that you've got people saying science, evidence, reason, but you've got at the same time this experiential story narrative approach. So, and I think even science, you know, yes, we've got more people formally educated, more people with degrees, and the scientific method dominates there, but it's a softer form than it used to be. And logic and reason don't dominate that university learning environment. Therefore, people are saying science, but I think there's a subjective nature to it. And certainly story and one's own experience does, you know, dominate even over that. So there's this fragmentation of views, that's the point.
I think I heard from you a moment ago, and I might have just missed you as you said it. Did you say in modernity we were off in science, then we went to questioning that in post-modernity, and then did you say there's been some sort of swing back? Or was that what you said? I'm just not
pretty
sure.
Pretty much, yeah. I find consistently when you analyse trends, society doesn't head down one road, but it's a pendulum that swings back and it auto-corrects back to where it was. And so, you know, in the post-modernism, was probably a bit too foggy and vague for everyone from an epistemological perspective. And so there is this little swing back to reason and evidence and logic.
So I'll just tell you how it's played out as I've thought about doing it, and then I'll ask you where we go next. When I wrote the course Introducing God in 2003, I was really thinking reaching the postmodern. And so, to use a line, I was thinking about that uni girl. And so I said, you may not believe that the Bible is authoritative. I'm not asking you to. What I'm inviting you to do is to come with me on a walk in my worldview. Do you know? So I'm just saying, come with me on a walk. And then as we go through over the number of weeks, by the time we get to the resurrection night, then we deal with truth. But I've had 6 weeks of wielding the sword of the Spirit before I get to the truth debate. Do you know? And because the truth debate was so contentious in post-modernity, do you know, that I don't want to have that on the first week. But now, decade, 15 years later, we've got all these new atheists out saying strongly that Christianity is bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
Dawkins' aggressive book titles. If you're going to write a course called Introducing God, then there's actually got to be a bit of a robust pushback, I think, to get any kind of cut through. And that sounds to be consistent with what you're saying.
Exactly. You know, so what's happened is that while the number of people attending church as a proportion has largely remained unchanged, about 15 or 16%, it's been consistent for more than a decade. What has changed is the rest of society less likely to say Christianity. So the context in which we're operating is less likely to be warm terrain. And when we surveyed Australians and asked them, well, which of these 7 statements sort of sums your view up, we now have 26% of Australians quite cold towards Christianity. Things like, I'm passionately opposed to Christianity. I've got real reservations with Christianity. I've got strong issues with Christianity. So you're getting a larger group that are pushing back on Christianity, again, because they will cite evidence or issues that Christianity might cause. That's part of the context in which mm-hmm. we're now communicating.
Mm-hmm. What about the phraseology? Now, we phrasing Christian faith in evangelism in relational terms rather than in structural terms. What I'm meaning is, have you met my friend Jesus? You know, have you met the most important person in my life, Jesus? Rather than, I want to persuade you to become a Christian. Do you want to just talk on that for a sec?
Sure. Well, you know, I think in these days, as that pendulum swings back, it's probably getting us back to a bit more balance, that yes, it's truth and reason and evidence, but it's one's experience and the heart and not just the head, you know. And I think if we can communicate to both the head and the heart, we will start to engage with this more educated generation that's more narrative based at the same time, and hopefully, you know, speak to both of those elements.
Mm. What advice do you give church leaders, denominational leaders, that they need to take on board in the light of the research that you've done?
Well, it's to make sure that, you know, when we're preaching, when we're running our ministries, we have a level of sophistication, again, mm-hmm. because we've got a pretty savvy, globally tuned in, aware and educated emerging generation.
Yep.
So, you know, some sophistication. It can't just be the fluff. It can't just be hype. Because we've moved on from that era, and this yep. generation sees through that. They're whip smart, and they're not afraid to push back.
Yep.
But at the same time, it has to speak to the heart, because, you know, what do we have in this society? A generation looking for purpose and meaning, that we've got mental health issues, anxiety issues, what we call sometimes the quarter-life crisis.
Yep.
Forget midlife, it's in your 23, 24, 25-year-olds that they're saying, what am I doing with life? I haven't achieved. You know, and this is stuff of the heart, of purpose and belonging and meaning. It's a generation that has been provided with more than any other generation in history, and yet has a sense of underachievement and a longing for what am I here for and what am I to do? You know, those timeless cries of the heart. So I think that, again, we need to attack both that experiential journey, but make sure there's fact, logic and reason, robustness as we communicate.
Mm. For youth leaders, ministering to Generation Z, what's the tips that you've got there as we're thinking about those teenagers? I'm thinking, you talk to us all about the screen, you know, but is it just, do we need to pursue technology? Or is it still actually they want to know that we love them? What's going on there?
Well, definitely, I think it's starting from the common ground and the timeless, you know, human needs. You know, it's Paul at Athens. You know, it's starting with their context a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, the context in previous generations was Christianity. There was some basic understanding. There was biblical literacy, that where Christianity or the church was at and society was at was quite similar. These days, society is over here and the church is over here. So to build that common ground, we've got to work a lot harder. And I think if we can start with that common ground, like Paul at Mars Hill there, start by quoting some of their, you know, poets or whatever is going on in their worldview, and then bring them to the things of Christ through that rationality, through that experiential approach as well, through one's own story, I think that starts to really speak their language.
Mm. Debt levels in Australia being so high, does that make any difference to Christian ministry?
Yeah, it does, because we've got now a new generation coming into their earnings years, unlike the baby boomers. You know, the baby boomers got a foothold in property in their mid-20s.
Yep.
By the time they're in their mid-30s, you know, the house prices were a lot lower, the mortgage was paid down a lot, and they were into it and they were able to volunteer. They weren't stressed out. One income-earning household could do it. That was the Aussie dream.
Yeah.
These days, you've got that same life stage now, Generation X, and it's two incomes, and they're juggling lots of roles, and they've got a longer commute time than ever, and they've got bigger debt than ever, and uncertain property market. And yes, you know, baby boomers had some tough times too with high interest rates, but Generation X, and particularly the Gen Y,
it feels much more stressful than it. I mean, we've got the Generation Z don't care, but it just feels like the generation above them, when they've actually realised, I've got to start caring, it feels like a very stressful time.
It is. And therefore, you know, getting them into the volunteer roles, getting them to attend various events, it is a bit harder. You've got to work harder there. There's just greater mobility. People will rent later in life. People will move across more homes. People start off with the townhouse and then upgrade to a detached home after that. So there's more mobility than used to be the case when you buy that Aussie dream, that home, and you start the family there, you raise the kids there, and they're living as empty nesters many years later. That's changed, and so it's harder to get that same tenure or connection with our people these days.
Mm. One slightly out of left field. There's different models of church. There's kind of supermarket model of church where you come and there's everything that you want in the one place, and then there's corner shop model of church. And any thoughts from the research about where we should put our eggs or...
Mm. Well, you use the word shops there, and we've done some analysis on what Australians look for in their communities. What's the backbone of where
great.
They meet?
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be the pub or the local community centre, whatever. We've looked at these days, and pretty high up on the list is the parks and the walking, mm-hmm. walkable neighbourhoods. That matters a lot. We've become a bit more densified and urbanised, but the number one thing is the local shopping strip. That's the new... civic
community centre.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the village green of today. And so if we can learn from that, it shows that, you know, Australians are looking for that place of connection. We're perhaps living in more apartments and don't know our neighbours. Maybe we're moving more frequently, don't know those around us, but we still have that need for community. And if the church can be in those bump spaces, if the church can provide some of that connection point, that's going to work. Bring it back to the style of church. People don't have as many social bottlenecks through which they connect these days. Not part of the local service organisation, not volunteering up here anymore. And again, if we can provide that social connection, not as the goal, but that's a key part of invitation.
I mean, when you think about a building like the one we're in at the moment, a church building, 100 years ago, when this building was built first, there was no real social relational spaces. You know, the community knew each other, and then together they went to church. Whereas now, we've got to make community here, because we've got a whole lot of people who are effectively hydroponic plants. Mm-hmm. They've just been plonked out of wherever and plonked into the tank, and they don't know each other. And actually, we need to help them know each other.
Yes, exactly. Well, 1 in 4 Australian households are solo person households.
And it's higher here.
Yeah, well, that's right. But you know, even, I mean, nationally, that's a lot, isn't it? It's the fastest growing household type. And yes, it's older people, but it's also students, it's young people, it's middle-aged people moving through change in their household
dynamics. It's got to mean loneliness, doesn't it?
It's
got to mean, as you said, crying out for belonging, crying out to be loved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're people of reconciliation and relationship. Not just the horizontal ones, but the vertical one.
And that's actually our strong suit, to deal with belonging, to deal with love.
Exactly, Dominic. And, you know, just picking up on the shops, there's a slight cynical aspect to it, that the shop is the new village green, and yet it requires commerce and a credit card and money, whereas the church doesn't.
Yeah.
It provides that community, no funds required, come as you are, you know, and let's have authentic community. It's not a privately facilitated space of commerce. And so... that's the place the church should be.
Mark McCrindle, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks, Dominic.
My guest this afternoon has been Mark McCrindle on The Pastor's Heart, and we've been talking the whole subject of the Australian community and that community and church summit. On the link on the pastorsheart.net page, we'll put the slides from Mark's presentation last week, so that you could check out those slides if you're interested. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you again at the same time next week.
Hey, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you could hop over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and review. That helps us in the rankings and lets other people discover The Pastor's Heart. And again, if you are able to help us out by being a financial partner, go to our Patreon link, patreon.com/thepastorsheart.